Our next case for this morning is Golden against Helen Sigman and Associates, 08-1506. And Mr. Golden, anytime you're ready.
Morning. May it please the court. The lower court found that there was no sanctions to be assessed in connection with count three. That's the 1983 count against Ms. Sigman. The court's reasoning was that under the Scheib v. Grant case, it's an issue of fact. You have to find that to have an absolute privilege, absolute immunity, you have to find that, in fact, the statements, the conduct were intrinsically related and intimately associated with the GAL's role. And on that basis, since discovery was stayed, the lower court said, we are not going to enter any sanctions for count three. So far, so good. Now you turn to the state court, the state claims against Ms. Sigman. And here, the court cited the same case, Scheib v. Grant, but said, there's absolute immunity. Absolute immunity, no questions asked, end of case, you're sanctioned for the state counts. That's confusing.
I thought the court explained that the reason it drew that distinction is because an immunity that is present for purposes of a state law claim needs to be respected in federal court. But just because the state gives immunity for certain claims doesn't mean that under the federal constitution and federal statutes in the 1983 side there would necessarily be the same immunity. There's plenty of law that says, you know, we respect what the states do on their side, but it doesn't necessarily carry over.
Well, but the court only relied on the Scheib case.
But the Scheib case was talking about a state immunity. It wasn't talking about 1980. The court actually goes on and cites cases from other circuits talking about 1983 in which it draws other conclusions, but it found, as you point out, for count three, that it was fuzzy enough that it wasn't worth or that it didn't justify Rule 11 sanctions.
Yes, and the language in Scheib v. Grant reads as follows. A GAL has absolute immunity from lawsuits arising out of statements or conduct intimately associated with the GAL's judicial duties. There has to be that factual inquiry. The absolute immunity is a creature of the common law, of state law, and whether it's applied to one cause of action or another, you still have the intimate association requirement. You require a factual inquiry.
But what the court did was it looked at the complaint to see what were the bases of the complaint, and I think it saw that these all arose out of the child representative's litigation activities or responsibilities, I'll say, for the protection of the child.
Well, what the lower court said was that it's not a slam dunk because of the allegations, but what the court didn't look at was the entire record and the record in the state court, which pointed out several matters that went beyond what's in the Third Amendment complaint, such as Sigman appearing for a fee petition, submitting a fee petition, but not appearing, and on this very same day, the judge recuses herself. And
Golden, I have a question for you, though. Why is this case in federal court at all? The state courts are available to hear virtually every claim that you're talking about.
Well, they can't bring a copyright claim. Infringement. Count one, cannot bring in state court.
We're not dealing with that right now either. That's
right.
Going on. But the claims that are presently before us, what does the federal court add? And don't you risk at many points, as the district court recognized, Rooker-Feldman issues with respect to preclusion, issues with respect to comedy? I mean, we aren't really the supervisors of the state courts.
Correct. And Rooker-Feldman was discussed and was pointed out that maybe there was one issue where Rooker-Feldman would have some impact. That was the Amanda Williams deposition. But that was the only issue that the lower court even remotely thought could be considered Northern District review, federal court review of a lower court decision. Brought in federal court because of count one, because of count two, because of count three. And not only do we disagree with the finding of sanctions, we don't think count three should have even been dismissed. The issue of state actor is also an issue of fact. And not only was there the suggestion of some ex parte communication with the judge who, in a rarity, recused herself on the same day that Ms. Sigmund did not show up for her fee petition, and over in domestic relations, a fee petition is a slam dunk. It's called a summary proceeding, but what in fact happens many times is an attorney, a family law attorney, shows up and says, "Your Honor, I need another $100,000, and the judge says, put in the order. That's what a summary proceeding is. And so when Ms. Sigmund did not show up, which is rare, and on the same day the judge recused herself, there's a suspicion there that something may be askance. Secondly, when Ms. Sigmund told the minor child, "That's important, I'm going to go tell it to the judge," but you can look at the record, which is publicly available, subject to your judicial review, there's no pleading where Ms. Sigmund has said anything whatsoever to the judge about what the minor child related, and there's nothing been orally stated either.
None of that makes the GAL a state actor. Even accepting what you say as the truth, none of that makes the GAL a state actor. The GAL is the child's lawyer.
I'm talking about the aspect of state action that relies on a conspiracy. We're saying these facts
that's
indicate
that's not sufficient to plead a conspiracy.
Well,
and
conspiracy
can support state action, color of state law liability against the GAL.
It's the question of, was there a conspiracy? Could a conspiracy be inferred? By definition, a conspiracy is something that is not in the open.
That she fails to show up for a court hearing?
Where she was going to be getting fees automatically, and on the same day the judge recuses herself?
No, that's not sufficient to support a conspiracy claim. The primary basis for the dismissal of the Section 1983 claim, or at least the threshold basis, was because none of the defendants were acting under color of state law. And it seems to me that's an alternative basis to award fees on that claim, or to at least affirm the district court's award of fees, even though that's not what the district court rested the award on.
Well, the district
court, that claim was certainly properly dismissed. There was absolutely nothing to support a 1983 claim against any of these defendants because none of them were acting under color of state law, and that's very clear from the case law.
What we're relying there is on the suspicion that there was a conspiracy based on ex parte communications with the court.
But after Twombly and Iqbal, I mean, maybe you could have gotten in the door at one point, but I think post-Twombly and Iqbal, I don't think that's enough.
How could Sigmund be a state actor?
But the law is that if you're in a conspiracy with a state actor, which a judge is, then you are deemed to be part of the conspiracy and the state action is imputed to you. May I address?
If you would like to say, it's up to you. You can either address another point or save a minute or two for rebuttal.
Well, I would like to give the other side an opportunity because I want to address.
Wait and.
Well, I'd like to address for a minute the other defendant, Ms. Thomas, because they're here to speak, and if I don't say anything, they're not going to.
You are in your rebuttal time.
Okay. So. I'm going to go over this very quickly. With regard to the Thomas complaint, the allegation was that there was no criminal activity. You knew there was no criminal activity, and therefore there was no suspicion of criminal activity, and you have no absolute privilege. You get into Rogers v. Wood, which is a really interesting Seventh Circuit case because, number one, it throws out the absolute privilege, but after it did so, the plaintiffs sought sanctions from the defendant, the attorney, Mr. Wood, who was the one who alleged the absolute privilege. And the court said, no, that was a good faith argument for an extension of existing law. Well, how can Golden have been sanctioned when he basically said this is existing law, there is no absolute privilege, when sanctions was an issue that the Seventh Circuit had to address and avoided sanctions by saying, but Mr. Wood, you made an argument, a good faith argument for the extension of existing law. Thank you very much.
Okay, sure. Thank you. Ms. Argentati?
May it please the Court, Patricia Argentati on behalf of Helen Sigmund and her law firm. Ms. Sigmund was appointed the GAL in this very difficult dissolution case back in March, I believe, of 04. And since February of 05 through November of 05 dealt with the allegations against her. It is our position clearly that the November of 05 dismissal of all allegations against her, the plaintiff has waived any right to appeal that. He's repeatedly stated to the district court that he was accepting Judge Gottschall's dismissal as a basis for not having fees imposed upon him.
But, you know, when people say things like that in district courts, sometimes the only thing they mean to convey is, I accept your ruling, judge, and whatever may happen on the upstairs chain is a different matter, but I'm not going to pester you with a million motions to reconsider. So I'm not sure that we have to read it as rigidly as you're suggesting.
Well, the point is, since November of 05, so now for almost 4 years, we have dealt with Mr. Golden's objections, repeated filings, arguments.
All the more reason to think he didn't mean to shut the door. Is the state court case over finally?
I believe the dissolution case, and I'm not directly involved in that, is ongoing, but I don't have personal knowledge about that. Certainly the state court is available to address many of the claims raised against Ms. Sigmund. We feel that the district court properly dismissed the claims on the various bases cited by the court, starting with the Rooker-Feldman doctrine.
What's your response to the point Mr. Goldman makes about the tension between the 1983 ruling, no sanctions, and the sanctions for the state law claims?
I will point out that the district court indicated it was a very close call. I think it shows that the district court was being very careful in its evaluation.
Close call meaning what?
That fees could well have been imposed for that count.
Close to
well.
Sanctioning on 1983, not close to not sanctioning on
absolutely.
State.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was the judge's ruling, both verbally and in writing. That I think it shows that the district court very carefully went through everything in a painstaking fashion, as did Magistrate Keyes, in attempting to determine whether fees were appropriate here. And, in fact, went on record as saying it's pervasive. The type of misconduct here pervaded the entire litigation, although it was a close call as to that particular count, and elected not to impose fees on that count. We suggested, in light of the magistrate judge's recommendation and Judge Gottschall's partial acceptance of that, that since there were three categories of cases against Ms. Sigmund, the state claims, the 1983 and the RICO, that the court looked to, it was very difficult to separate out which activities addressed which particular allegation or claim. We did provide, I might point out to the court, unredacted billing records of Ms. Sigmund to the district court. So the court,
this the record that came up to this court?
No, I believe Judge Gottschall took them under seal. They were not part because of an attorney-client privilege, a part of the official record. We were contacted by your clerks and asked whether they were actually made a part of the official record or just taken under seal, and when we were advised it was simply under seal per the judge's instruction, we were not asked to provide those. But Judge Gottschall did have those to review. And the court actually elected Mr. Golden's solution in response to NPM's motion. It was Mr. Golden who suggested there's only one count where fees are being considered, and therefore why don't you consider it on a count-by-count basis? In fact, I believe that's what the district court did in awarding fees in this case. She took it on a count-by-count basis. There were seven counts alleged against Ms. Sigmund, eight counts against Ms. Sigmund. Fees were imposed on seven of them. We elected out as best we could those things that were attributable to alleged sanctionable conduct, and those that were not alleged to be sanctionable. And for that reason, we feel that the fees imposed were entirely appropriate and reasonable, and the plaintiff appellant has shown nothing that would indicate abuse of discretion, which, of course, is the standard that's required in this case. So for all of those reasons, we'd ask that this court affirm the dismissal if it seems that that has not been waived, but certainly affirm the award of sanctions and consider that this appeal itself is a frivolous pleading. Thank
What's
you.
What's your response to Mr. Golden's conspiracy theory as to state action?
Judge, with all due respect, there was nothing shown in anything produced in the record. And I might say that some of the facts and comments that we've been addressed here today nowhere appear in the record and were never considered by the district court because they were never brought forward. So I would say that based on the allegations alone, there's certainly nothing to support that. Dismissal of all claims against Ms. Sigmund was appropriate. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Peldyuk.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court and Counsel. My name is Paul Peldyuk, and I represent the appellee, Nancy Frank Thomas. Mr. Golden brought up a point during his oral argument about the Rogers case and its applicability to this case to preclude sanctions on behalf of Mrs. Thomas that were awarded in the lower court. We, of course, believe that the Rogers case is totally inapplicable to this situation. The reason is because of the distinction between the federal statute in Rogers and the state or the City of Chicago ordinance that Mr. Golden relies upon. The specific differences are that the Rogers case dealt with the unauthorized interception and disclosure of communication. In that case, the crime is complete based on an objective standard. If you intercept communication, you make an unauthorized disclosure, there is a breach. And if there is a breach, the statute itself provides a private cause of action for that breach and for damages.
Isn't that the critical difference, that there's no private right of action under these 911 statutes?
Well, that's one of the differences, Your Honor. Yes, there is no private cause of action, and Mr. Golden attempts to engraft it upon the ordinance, which we don't believe exists. And otherwise, Your Honor, I don't think there are any issues that, unless the Court has questions, that I could possibly address that were not addressed in the brief. I can touch briefly upon one, perhaps, that the Court may inquire upon, and that would be the when the Court relinquished jurisdiction over the state court claims, if that created any basis for a lack of jurisdiction to award sanctions thereafter. I don't think it did, because the order was non-final, was subject to being vacated at any time, and only later were the sanctions then filed, completely vetted and heard in the lower court by two judges, Magistrate Judge Keyes and Judge Gottschall, both of which passed upon the propriety of the sanctions. And for those reasons, we ask that those sanctions be affirmed in favor of Mrs. Thomas. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I think you have a little less than a minute, Mr. Golden, but I'll give you a full minute.
One point I'd like to make is that with regard to Ms. Thomas, the lower court found that there were going to be no sanctions for the conspiracy count with regard to Ms. Thomas, but the lower court said we're going to hold sanctions against Mr. Golden for the same conspiracy count. Well, it's been a long time, but I still think it takes two to tango. If one co-conspirator, there's no sanctions involved, the other co-conspirator can have no sanctions involved. In terms of the allegations that Ms. Argentati indicated were not in the record, they are in the record. The reply brief at page 9 in the footnote indicates exactly what the allegations were, where they appear in the record, so they are in the record. The last issue I want to mention is the one we've all avoided, which is the timing. No matter how frivolous, no matter how poor the complaint was, when you engage in this kind of delay over a year between a knowing delay, between knowing of the violation and actually filing, it's too long. Sullivan v. Hunt says it. The Zavo rule is gone. When you wait 9 months between filing and service of a Rule 11, it's too long. When you wait 4 months to do anything after you believe a claim is bad, it's too long. And Judge Posner and many decisions written by other judges have held, we don't care how meritorious it is. The whole concept of Rule 11 is to expedite litigation, and you can't wait 4 months, 8 months, 9 months, or 15 months to proceed with your claim.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very
much.
We respectfully, obviously, would request that the sanctions be reversed and the case be remanded on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We